so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Fred D. Ledley. He's a physician, scientist, entrepreneur, and educator who's authored over 200 articles on topics ranging from molecular biology, biotechnology, STEM education, business, and bioethics. He is currently a professor of natural and applied science and management and the director of a center of integration of science and industry at Bentley University. He served on the faculties of Howard Hughes Medical Institute, Baylor College of Medicine, Texas Children's Hospital. He has an MD, he has a bachelor's in physical science, and he was a postdoctoral fellow at my alma mater, MIT, with Dr. David Baltimore. He's a novelist, and he seems to be the kind of person that INET is delighted to have explore this enormous, complex web that goes from public funding of science to the final creation of pharmaceutical products, drugs that benefit health and mankind. But the process is not self-evident. And I welcome you, Fred, for being here with me. This is, this is an enormously important topic at this juncture in time with the pandemic, with the wide open support for basic science and research related to a COVID vaccine. And so I'm thrilled that you could join me today and begin exploring this for our listeners.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk from your working paper that you wrote recently for INET with Katarina Gokina-Cleary and Matthew Jackson. You talk about government as the first investor in the biopharmaceutical innovation. And there's a lot of empirical work that you've done with over 9 years of data related to drug approvals. But before we get to the evidence and the functioning or malfunctioning of the system, can you describe from the very beginning through the transitional science and all of the different, transitional science to the various elements, what I will call from R to D to the realization of products?
Sure. This is a incredibly important process with a lot of pieces. And in our work, we approach this very much as a system where we have to recognize that there is a process that begins with basic science. And basic science is often pretty obscure stuff. It's research usually led by scientists in the pursuit of knowledge. That's kind of the definition that National Science Foundation uses. And they'll study obscure organisms like worms or fruit flies or cells in culture to understand basic mechanisms of biology. By understanding those basic mechanisms, they also find insights into what maintains our health and what goes wrong in disease. And once you begin to understand these pathways for disease and for health, and also for prevention of disease, it will provide insights into how you might now change those processes by administering a drug, by changing a health behavior, by changing your nutrition. And we distinguish this process of basic science, which is very much non-directed, from what we call translational or applied science, where these insights are taken by a different set of scientists, people who are trained in medicine, in clinical research, in producing products and advanced chemistries. And they take these insights and find molecules that we can give as a pill or an injection to preserve our health. What's important is that these two different spheres of activity are very different, but they also take place in different circumstances. Basic science is usually funded by the public sector. It takes place largely in nonprofit institutions, and the vast majority of it is funded by governments. Philanthropy funds some, but the amount the governments fund, and we'll talk about the amounts, is measured in the hundreds of billions of dollars. It's not inexpensive. It's, as I mentioned, can be very arcane to outsiders. But evidence suggests, and our evidence suggests, it's very powerful and is remarkably efficient in providing insights that lead to products that we take every day in the form of drugs. So that's the core process. In contrast to the basic science, the applied science is largely funded by industry. Our work shows in the past 10 years, every single drug that's come to market in the United States has in fact been developed. This applied development process has taken place in industry. This is also not inexpensive. Estimates are that it costs about $1 billion or $1.5 billion to take the fruits of basic research, translate that into a product that's safe and effective, and it's the companies that then manufacture it. And as we'll talk about, it's companies that then set the price and make it available to the public. And very frequently, the return to the public investment, that early stage investment in basic science, what Mariana Mazzucato calls the investor of first resort. It's very frequently forgotten, and it's not necessarily in the equation of who profits from the product at the end.
So when you say it's forgotten, meaning at some level there is no financial return or no acknowledgement or both?
Well, so both. I think it's, in one sense, people don't really care whether the drug they take to cancer originated from studies in an earthworm. As a matter of fact, they probably don't want to know. So that it people are unaware of it. And are in a society that's not tremendously scientific literate, people don't really appreciate the basic science. But also there's very limited reimbursement. There are mechanisms which we can talk about in the United States, a law called the Bayh-Dole Act, which organizes and operationalizes what's called the transfer of the basic science to industry. And while there are mechanisms to provide a return to the public sector, they're very limited.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess the imagination that one would have, and we've done work with Mariana Mazzucato, is that what would have made sense is that there be what you might call an equity stake, meaning bearing risk, but the basic science that contributes to the research and then eventually to the development is an investor in the process, and that there would be an equity stake for the government to, how would I say, receive returns for success that could be plowed back into further development. And that's missing. Is there a reason why that's missing? I mean, at one level, I can understand a free market ideologue would say, well, this is all done by the private sector and it's magic, and they'd be interested in denial of the co-participation of government that Mariana and others have emphasized. But what's going on? Why isn't there, you know, you have all of these budget hawks. I'm an economist, and all these people that are always worried about the deficit. Why aren't they advocating for a return in a marketplace on something that the government has contributed to?
Well, it's a great question, Rob. And I think there are a couple of practical answers. And there's also just the biggest answer that people haven't really been aware of it. I tell a story. We were inspired to do this work by one of my postdoctoral fellows who used to watch C-SPAN in the lab. And she wanted to go into policy. And she brought to our attention an encounter where Senator Dick Durbin asked the director of the NIH, can you connect the dots between this public funding, this public investment? Because investment is really the right word. Can you connect the dots between this public money and particular products coming to market? And it's one of the few times, and the answer was no one had ever done it. We all believe it. It's built into our policy. There's a lot of theory. We teach it in management courses. But there was really very little empirical evidence to show what Kat Cleary in our group showed a couple of years ago and is expanding on now, that every single drug coming to market has the benefit of public sector investment in the underlying research. So that's the first issue, is that there has been a lack of evidence. The second is that it's not a straight line. It is very difficult to draw a nice, connect the dots kind of line between some of the observations of basic science and the products coming out. Kat Cleary has also shown that sometimes the work is done in the context of an entirely different disease or condition. So the people who think they're studying arthritis may end up making a contribution to developing a cancer drug. So that there is this value of this enormous cloud of knowledge that's assembled in basic science. And we're used to much simpler stories. We all like to think about assembly lines. That problem is built into economics, and it's also built into accounting. So the traditionally in economics historically, and Mariana Mazzucato has written about this, has a lot of trouble valuing government contributions. So that there is, it's an evolving area in economics, somewhat outside of my field. But the same problem exists in accounting. And that is, in a company, research is not considered tangible. It does not have tangible value. And that term, colloquial terms, they don't treat it as having tangible value, but it also goes to this notion of investment and return on investment. And that's a historical problem. It's begun to be redressed in the economics world, which now will look at creative works in calculating GDP, for example, that includes biomedical research. But it has not been addressed in the investment world. So they just don't have to deal with it. There's no pressure for them to deal with it. And government policy has not caught up to create the necessity of being sure that the public gets an appropriate reimbursement or appropriate return on their investment.
I worked 6 years in the United States Senate, and as I'm listening to you, my imagination is just swirling around with various, ideas, possibilities. And one of which is there any evidence that when a product is very profitable for a monopolistic company, that they lobby to stop basic research from something that could compete with that product? Because I can imagine fundraisers for congressmen and senators that are devoted to what you might call inspiring them to thwart certain research that would introduce competition for a profitable product.
So companies are very active on the back end of this, of protecting their exclusivity with patents, with a lot of lobbying. A lot of mechanisms have been created, many with the best intentions, that prolong the exclusivity, give people monopolies for longer times. So this originated with the Orphan Drug Act, which was amazingly effective in getting companies to pay attention to rare diseases, many of the diseases I started in working on in my career, at the price of prolonged exclusivity. It also was built into a drug act to encourage companies to test drugs in children and pediatric dosing. In exchange, companies get 6 months of additional exclusivity. So it was a bit of a Pandora's box. And once it was open, once the issue of exclusivity was negotiable, it has been very much taken advantage of by industry in all sorts of ways. And it's a whole issue in itself. The basic research, you know, up to the present time, and this is one of the tragedies of this current COVID era, is politicians have largely kept their hands off basic science over the last 70 years. It really was a principle of the modern world coming out of World War II, embodied in a very famous publication called The Endless Frontier, that basic science should be really happen without interference. A little more government control than I think Vannevar Bush had in mind. But it's been, even to this day, it's one of the few bipartisan things in Congress to get money for basic science and largely keep people's hands off it. In the last couple of months, that's been severely challenged. And it was also challenged in the era of embryonic stem cells. And so occasionally it gets challenged. But by and large, the basic science, industry knows, industry backs basic science too, because they know they need it. They understand this. They understand this is their seed, that they need this constant flow of ideas and knowledge and much of it very substantive to continue fueling their pipelines. And so the basic science part has been relatively safe. It's the back end where a lot of complexity exists.
Well, I can imagine. Let me go back to my question, which was, are people, deterring basic research that might interfere with their profitability? I think you raised in your answer a very interesting dilemma for our audience, which is at one level, by giving them exclusivity or giving them patent rights, you inspire them, because of profit, to do more at their stage of development. And on the other hand, if you grant too much monopoly power or you allow what I'll call predatory deterrence of basic research, you harm many things to preserve that monopoly power. So it's kind of a yin and yang sort of context, and I can see arguments on both sides. But as I look at this, what concerns me as I read your paper most is there's no payback for the basic research. There aren't property rights that are defined. And therefore, what the public should want, given that as taxpayers they've collectively subsidized this entire process, is what you might call wide and inexpensive dissemination to the public that reflects that subsidy and cost that took place way upstream in the translational realm that you describe. But monopoly power at the level of practical applied products and higher pricing frustrates, or because of its expense, makes dissemination less broad-based, less impactful, and it kind of reduces what I'll call the social rate of return of the entire endeavor. How do we what you might call discipline downstream, so that upstream's subsidy maximizes the benefit to the public?
So it's a great question. There are really two approaches. The current system is totally organized around patents. So the design of the Bayh-Dole Act in the 80s, which was ultimately designed to ensure the public return on this investment. So the act obligates the universities to do the research to look for ways to commercialize products. The act anticipates that commercialization is the process that will make it available. And the act actually has relatively few protections against the more egregious abuse of this commercialization privilege. There's some in there that people are trying very hard to find ways to leverage, but the act was really intended, the intent was that when a product comes out, that product which improved health, and this largely relates to health, but also other things, that product was the thing that the public really wanted in return. So that was the design of the act, but it was built around patents. And a patent, almost by definition, is not basic science, right? The patent, in fact, describes only the product once you've already discovered it, once you already know a lot about it, once you have demonstrated it has utility, which is an important word in the patent world, and also that you know how to make a product. And, you know, think back to when we talked about basic science. Basic science isn't intended to do that. So the basic science got totally left out of this equation. And so the first issue is that if you're going to stick with patents as the organizing principle here, then there have to be controls on it. And you also have to now find ways to monetize, to value the basic science that's coming out. And so one approach, which is one that Mazzucato talks about in her books, is that we should think about the return on investment. Oddly enough, we were introduced to this concept by Representative Ocasio-Cortez, who very interestingly, though she describes herself as a socialist, she's the one who asked this incredibly insightful question at a committee hearing once, where she asked, you know, a venture capitalist wants a return for taking risk. The government's taking way more risk here. Should they get a bigger return? And the answer is yes. If you're going to treat intellectual property and patents as a commodity, then we need ways to value it and provide a return. The other approach you alluded to is what's called open innovation, which is exactly the opposite. And it's the notion that all the work that's done by the public sector really belong, that intellectual property itself belongs to the public. And that the way to provide a return is to put it all out there in the public domain. And there's a lot of evidence that this could speed innovation. It's a very elegant notion. But if the world goes to that, that is also open to abuse, because that would eliminate the ability to have any controls over companies that now use that innovation to develop proprietary products. So there has to be, you still have this problem of if all the value is associated with the patent itself, that product, then you still leave the public out from getting a direct return on investment. Now, that said, Bayh-Dole also anticipates the public gets indirect returns on investment. So the act was designed to promote American industry by licensing to American companies. It talks about job creation. It anticipates profits, and with profits and revenue should come taxes. And so you end up with this entire, having to address this the entire financialization of this industry, which is avoiding taxes, may not be creating jobs, which are the other things that were anticipated in the act. We think this has to be rethought. We think it's time to value the basic science directly, to value the contributions of the public sector directly, to have some limits on that makes sure that the drugs are available and affordable to the public, because that's ultimately that value the public's getting back. That health capital is ultimately the goal of bringing a drug to market. And any person who can't get it, it reduces the return to the public. And so we think that the Bayh-Dole just isn't broad enough, that it's not capturing and it's not ensuring these different mechanisms of value creation for the public that were anticipated.
As I'm listening to you, it's resonating with the kind of things I hear related to cybersecurity, where many people who work in the intelligence community or the defense industry have felt that DARPA, NSA, and others had spawned the development of Silicon Valley. And yet they are quite frustrated now because the American taxpayer, guided by these officials, are providing the basic research, and it's diffusing, particularly to China, where there's concern about cybersecurity and national security risk. And in my own life, I once went to a birthday party at the House of Lords, and I was seated at a dinner table, and I asked the various people at the table, what were they doing? And they said, well, we're mostly on the boards of pharmaceutical companies. I said, oh, that's interesting. What's your strategy? And they said, there's a very simple strategy in pharmaceutical industry these days. What you do is you set up a subsidiary in the United States and you make all kinds of profit and use that to cross-subsidize the development of your market share every place else in the world. And they were talking about this, which you might call political economic manipulation that protected monopoly profits, as something they wanted to get in on in order to, how would I say, improve their penetration of markets in, say, continental Europe, like Germany and France. So, and they spoke very, very vehemently about how the American market was what you might call the exception or in some ways more protected for the industry than any other place on earth.
Yeah, so the United States really is providing the fuel on both ends for pharmaceuticals. On one hand, we tracked $230 billion of taxpayer money that can be linked to the drugs that came out in the last decade. So, and I will say that's not all of it. The EU puts a lot of money into research as well. Japan puts a fair amount in. So there's a lot of public money coming in, but the National Institutes of Health has historically been kind of the epicenter for that. American investors will invest in things that are less common in Europe, including companies that are very early stage. That money helps advance things. But most importantly, it's the lack of controls on prices. That everyone always tries to rationalize drug prices, that they should relate to the cost of manufacture, or the cost of development, or value-based pricing. And they're very elegant thinking on every one of those approaches. But the fact is, we don't do that. There are no controls on prices. The industry treats this as a product that, and will price it as to what the market and also the political market will bear. And that's very different than the rest of the world. And because, we are an affluent company, the market is they're finding that they can sell drugs at incredibly high prices. It's an inelastic market, so that if someone has cancer, they're not sitting there with a calculator, hopefully. And so on both ends, the United States has been really feeding this with cash, on the basic science end, the development end, and ultimately on the returns on investments. You know, one of the things we're very concerned about is the industry will always argue that they need the profits to invest back in R&D. And there's a lot of R&D. Pharmaceutical industry does about $140 billion of R&D a year worldwide. But there's even more being siphoned out of the system in the form of distributions to shareholders. We had a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association back at the beginning of the year, which is largely drowned out by COVID. But, you know, we're talking about trillions of dollars, you know, over about $1.7 trillion of stock buybacks and dividends by the largest pharmaceutical companies over the last 20 years. And it's really hard to get a grip on big numbers, but it's also really important. But that's in the same order of magnitude. Franklin Bright, a postdoctoral fellow in my group, is looking at that amount relative to the deficit of spending of the lower socioeconomic classes and what it would take to bring people up to a median healthcare expenditure. We're talking about the same order of magnitude. So we do, you know, the profits are funding R&D, but it's also taking a lot of money out of our healthcare system. And that's one of our major concerns.
Yeah. I've also heard many people say that that there is a tremendous amount of retail marketing. I mentioned to you when we were preparing for today that my father was a physician, and he was late in his career really quite offended to see retail marketing about complex drugs, where then his patients would come in and demand a drug because they saw what you might call a magnetic or attractive ad. And this had a kind of ugly irony. Late in my father's life, he suffered from Alzheimer's disease. And he took a drug called Aricept, which caused tremendous problems with his digestive system. But it was meant to arrest the decline of his mental capacities. Well, I was sitting with him one night when I saw an ad where a woman was in the kitchen, and her husband was concerned that she had some kind of forgetfulness or something that was bothersome as he watched her put a frying pan in the refrigerator. And then with beautiful music and everything else, there was this lovely discussion of how Aricept could help take care of that and someone that you loved could benefit. And I was just appalled. I was absolutely blown away. And I talked to my father's physician and he said, yeah, that ad, many people come and they have no awareness of these hideous side effects and how dangerous that drug is to other things. It's something you use in an extreme situation. And so I think the, what you might call the notion that everything is plowed back into R&D and the notion that which you might call appealed to the retail environment for lots of these complex drugs that should only be allocated by a physician makes me somewhat more skeptical about what the returns are being used for.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, that's if you needed a better symbol of how drugs are treated by the industry, they are treating it as any other retail product. They run ads, they talk about market share, they talk about their market, you know, it's the same vocabulary. Our students, you know, we turn out a lot of really high quality students at Bentley in marketing, and they take the same training and they work in the pharmaceutical industry and they work in, you know, online retailers and every place else. We make a point. We actually introduce our working paper with the quote from the World Health Organization, which is always one of my favorites, that basically the declaration, the founding declaration of the World Health Organization, makes the point that healthcare is essentially a human right. And you know, it says the highest attainable standard of health is one of the fundamental rights of every human being. That's a very different concept than healthcare being talking about the affordability of healthcare, the market share of a product, particularly the concept of market share to a physician. I can imagine how your dad felt. That concept is very offensive. You actually want it to be available to anybody with the condition. And it shows how at odds these spheres really are.
Yeah, when my father was the head of the North Central Section of the American Urological Association, many pharmaceutical companies wanted to fly him to resorts and other things for meetings to essentially inspire him to be a representative of their company and their drugs. And he was quite allergic to that. I think he went on one trip or another to Kansas City and then found himself being manipulated, and he came home. He was quite disgusted by what people thought they could, what you might call, inspire him to do, given his mission in life. And his father was a physician as well.
I mean, so, what drives us is that while there certainly are many egregious things in industry, there are things industry is really good at. They are actually very good at developing drugs. I jumped from academia to industry. I was working in gene therapy. And as we began to get closer, we were one of the first groups in the world to have permission from the FDA and the likes to do experiments with gene therapy. We began to grapple with things you hear about now with vaccines, with quality control. You know, how to be sure it's safe and it's the same every time. And, you know, when you took a pill, I mean, we weren't doing pills, but when you take a pill, you want it to be exactly the same as the pill you took the day before and the day before, even though it may have been in your glove compartment for 6 months. When the school I was at formed a company, we were able to hire someone who's really good at that stuff. People are really good at manufacturing and process development. And things that we were not equipped to do in academia. And in general, that's not what we think universities should be doing. So that the partnership can be very, very powerful. The issue is getting the balance right, getting Bill Ozonek and Mazzucato have an article talking about the risk-reward, risk-return nexus, I think they call it. Making sure that you have the right balance, you have the right controls, that the overriding importance of medicines for people who need them should be the first principle. And then we take advantage of these very complementary capabilities, but also have controls against the more egregious overreaches. There was a time that the pharmaceutical industry did not behave like this. Bill Ozonek, talks about the increasing financialization of the industry over recent decades. But there were times when, famously, George Merck equated that, we should never forget that medicines are for people. A very famous quote that people in the industry use all the time. And they usually leave out the next line, which was, and the more you remember that, the more profit we'll make. And he made a lot of profit, but it was a different mentality that you can make money by doing good. It's what we teach when we talk about corporate social responsibility. It's much more prominent in the environmental people when they talk about ESG investing, that we really need to get this balance right to take advantage of the almost completely complementary, very little overlap in the capabilities of the public and private sector here. And it's just right now the playing field is a bit is quite tilted.
Well, we've been exploring what I'll call this process or pipeline, but your working paper that you just released for iNet with your co-authors includes a lot of very intense empirical work. And So we've talked a little bit about numbers and about scale, but people could say, well, yes, these guys are talking about some process, but it's inconsequential to societal well-being. But my understanding from reading your working paper is the scale upon which this is taking place is enormous, and that almost all of the new drugs were related to the basic and translational research that you describe. Can you share with us the nature of your results?
Yes. So we started by looking at every drug approved in the last decade in the United States. There was 356 drugs in our study, including some very important drugs for treating cancer, hepatitis C, migraines, you know, both common things and also uncommon life-threatening conditions. Our approach was to start by identifying every research paper that pertained to the drug or to what's called the target for the drug. And the target for the drug is just something in the body that drug physically attaches to and where it exerts its mechanism of action. So you can take a protein and make it less active or more active by administering a drug. And that describes the biology. That's the know-how. We call that basic science, that you have to know a lot about the targets and the mechanisms in order to develop a drug. And we found about 2.5 million research papers, just under 2.5 million. Again, big numbers, very hard to get your head around. And from those, we then tracked how many acknowledged getting funding from the National Institutes of Health, the NIH in the United States. And what we found was that there are hundreds of thousands of fiscal years of funding that went into this body of research. And the total investment by the NIH was $230 billion. It's really, a couple of things are really interesting about that number. First of all, it's really big, right? And, you know, people worry about, people are concerned frequently about millions of dollars, but hundreds of billions. We're not talking about something that's a little bit bigger. We're talking about something that's totally different. It's also interesting because that suggests government funding is actually quite efficient, which is not something you usually ascribe to government funding. But what that says is about 65% of all the basic research the government funded, the NIH funded, over the last 20 years, can already be linked to drugs approved in the last decade, directly or indirectly linked to a product that's out there to help people. 65% efficiency is a remarkably high number. I think most companies would be thrilled that if their investments were 65% productive. So it's a big number. It's a lot. Think of how many people are involved in all this, to have 2.5 million research publications. So it's a big enterprise. Importantly, about 90% of this was basic research, not applied research. So the research we found described the biology, the targets, the mechanisms of health and disease. Only about 10% of it actually related to the drug itself. And that's consistent with the model I introduced at the beginning, which is that the public sector is expected to do mostly this basic science. Then the industry actually does development. At the end of the day, industry developed every one of these drugs. We also interestingly looked at the patents. This government funding generated about 22,000 patents. Again, striking numbers. Of those patents, 27 of the drugs we studied seem to have been protected by those patents, less than 10%. Now, there's complexity to what that means. It means, for those who know the field, it means those are the patents listed in something called the Orange Book. But those are the patents that most obviously generate measurable value, tangible value to companies, to investors. Those are the only ones, those are the ones that have a chance of getting return on investment, whereas for most of the other products, there would not have been a return on the public sector investment. So that's it shows the limits of this patent-based mechanism as a way to codify and recognize the public contribution, and in fact leaves out most of this enormous investment that's being made. I'll also say that the public has many chances at winning, because many of the patents we found, much of the research we found was old and may have contributed to other drugs before 2010, and much of it is still contributing to drugs now. So, our conclusion is, this is money remarkably well spent. This is doing exactly what taxpayers intended it to do in terms of generating the basic science, but it may not be optimizing the public value that they get in return.
So it seems that you've established, given the empirical work you've done, that the public sector research is absolutely essential to the process. If you shut off the switch, a whole lot of things that are good things wouldn't happen in the private sector and in the marketplace.
So we know it's essential. One of the other things we do is that we actually model the maturation of science. There is a general understanding in engineering, comes from actually, that it's very hard to develop a product from a technology that's not mature. And in fact, the technological readiness or maturity is one of the biggest predictors of the ability to develop a product. This is true in computers and transportation and rockets and everything else. And we're able to show that it's very rare for drugs to get approved before the basic science is what we call established. It's a numerical definition. And not only that, when people try to jump in, try to accelerate it, and this is kind of a lesson for the COVID world too, there's real danger in trying to accelerate it and go with immature technologies. It takes longer, it's more expensive, and you run into more problems. So it just shows how important this publicly funded body of knowledge is to the eventual ability to develop a product. Without this, there's no pipeline. You don't have anything to work with.
And so I guess it's essential. It's not, as it's structured, generating returns. Tangible returns, not social returns, yes, but financial returns that would allow the government to, recirculate the proceeds of success to further research is not taking place. Downstream, the what I'll call monopolistic pricing and protection inhibits, as we talked about at the outset, the dissemination to the public of, and therefore the benefits of these public investments. As you look at this whole process, what types of reform are necessary? Is it antitrust? Is it price regulation? Downstream? Is it what you might call equity participation upstream? What are the things that you envision that would take us to a place where this very valuable public investment could be either further enhanced by returns or further benefit society through the way in which it propagates into the public? How do we improve on this process that you've discovered?
So we think it begins by recognizing the value of the public sector contribution. Until that's recognized, until it's quantified, until it has a seat on the table equal to the investment that the private sector is making, the public is at a disadvantage in this negotiation. So until one recognizes the value, the real value, and that it is tangible, it is necessary, it is an essential contribution to the products are coming out, and then can have a discussion among equals as to how, who controls pricing, who controls term, who controls exclusivity. As it is now, you know, we asked the question in one of the blogs we've done with iNet, why do the companies get to set the price? Right? It seems like a silly question, but it's actually not. It's complicated. It's not that they contribute to science. It's not that they invest the most money. It's not that they do the most work. It has to do with the fact that they have the patent. And patent is related to who really is the inventor. But what happens when there are two inventors simultaneously? One ends up with all the money and not the other one. And there are many examples of companies developing products, competing products, where one is shut out of the market, not because they didn't make the investment, not because they didn't do the science, but because their patent attorney wasn't as good as the other patent attorney. So this discussion needs to go away from patents into the value that's actually created. And we actually believe that the value being created by the public sector is substantial. The value being created by the private sector is also substantial. We in no way minimize that. But it needs to be a more equal distribution, a more equal footing, and a more equal negotiation of where those returns go. The public may negotiate not for a return on investment, but for lower prices. That would be reasonable. The public may decide that it's more efficient to take a monetary return on investment and invest it back in healthcare for those who can't afford it, or more R&D. But those are the discussions we should be having, not how to game the system to get more and more years of exclusivity.
Mm-hmm. And I would add to that, as our research director, Tom Ferguson, specializes in, is the role of money in politics and the way in which elected officials have to, unfortunately, appeal for their own survival to large concentrated financial donors, which makes them susceptible to playing a role in what I might say, keeping this system from evolving to the healthy place that your vision suggests it could migrate to.
So the public, you know, the public has a lot of ways to win here, right? The health capital matters. That's ultimately the goal here. That's the idea behind all the legislation that's been passed, at least on paper. And it's in everyone's interest to prime this pump. It's also an investor interest. The more research, the more products, the more people, the more people who stand to benefit from drugs. And we do believe there's an optimum point here where you optimize the health benefits, you optimize the job creation, you do optimize profits and economic growth as well. You have to work together to find that sweet spot of optimizing as opposed to one side having all the cards on their side of the table.
Yep. Well, this has been a superb tour, Fred. And I mean, first, the research itself is extraordinary. It's timely, it's germane to a very important problem, and it's deep and thorough. As I read your biography at the beginning, I can see how all the different places that you've, all the vantage points that you've developed in your awareness contributed to the depth and the breadth and the quality of this work. But I want to thank you for being here with me today. Any final thoughts that we haven't explored or covered that you would like to impart to the audience before we adjourn?
No, it's been a pleasure doing this. It's a pleasure working with so many of the INET scholars. We, as you mentioned, I really value the insights that come from different areas, different specialties, and it's rare to find the opportunity to bring all these things together. We have that, been very fortunate, Bentley, to do that. Really enjoyed working with INET and the scholars you've brought together as well.
Well, we're very fortunate to have a person with the skills of synthesis, integration, lateral pattern recognition that you provide, you and your colleagues. And I want to thank you again for being here today. As this process unfolds, because I'm sure health issues will be on center stage, I'd like to have the opportunity to bring you back onto the podcast, perhaps after the presidential election. We might together envision what kind of policies the next administration should consider to improve the system in the ways you've described today.
I look forward to it.
Me too. Thanks, and goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.